Today on Off Mic, the president and the first lady both test positive for COVID-19. What does this mean for the campaign? Until we hear otherwise, the campaign continues, and that means courting the Latino vote. Today we hear from a history professor on his book detailing the history of Latino support for the Republican Party, including for Donald Trump. We also hear from the candidates running to replace Congressman Pete Viscolosky. All this on Off Mic. Welcome to Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Michael Puente, reporter with WBEZ Chicago. It's estimated that 32 million Latinos will be eligible to vote in the general election. That's the most ever, and it also makes Latinos the largest voting bloc after non-Hispanic whites and more than African Americans. Historically, Latinos have voted with Democrats 70% to 30% for the GOP. But some say Latinos could vote in greater numbers for President Donald Trump. That seems a little odd to some, given Trump's rhetoric against Latinos. To get a better understanding of why Latinos vote Republican, I spoke to Geraldo Cadava, a history professor at Northwestern University near Chicago. He recently wrote the book, The Hispanic Republican. I interviewed Professor Cadava outside Manny's Deli in Chicago recently. My first question to Cadava, why did you write the book?
I wrote the book because I really want people from both parties to take Latinos seriously and as voters and political actors who have serious political ideas.
And part of it is a little bit about, I was going to say, how long did it take you to write, but actually your whole life, since it's a little bit about yourself.
That's right. Yeah, my grandfather is a Hispanic Republican. His name is Geraldo Cadava. He is just like mine, that is. He is Colombian and Panameño and Filipino, and he became a U.S. citizen by joining the U.S. military. And he voted for a Republican for the first time in 1980 when he voted for Ronald Reagan. And at the time, he was working in a silver mine outside of Tucson, Arizona. And Reagan was promising to put more money back into his biweekly paycheck with tax cuts. So he voted for a Republican for the first time for that single issue. But then over the past 40 years, and he's still alive, thankfully, has kind of embraced every position of the Republican Party wholesale. So kind of tracing that process and arguing with him about Latino politics for my whole life is, I'm sure, a big part of why I wrote this book.
Now, early in the book, you talk about how Hispanics in the like early part of the 19th century or 20th century were considered Republican.
Yeah.
Just like African Americans.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, a majority of Hispanics were Republicans until the New Deal, really. And then many Latinos kind of went over to the other side and started voting for Democrats because they thought that Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal kind of helped them get jobs, help put food on the table during tough economic times. African Americans also were Republicans at that time. The time when African Americans and Latinos kind of really parted ways in terms of their electoral behavior was during the 1960s, when Republicans embraced the Southern strategy and when the Republican Party kind of rejected the Civil Rights Bill of 1964. And that's when African Americans really abandoned the Republican Party, and very explicitly Nixon's strategists and the people close to him said that he needed to find the more voters, basically. I mean, because he was losing African American support, he had to pick up other votes somewhere, and Latinos were his kind of top target.
Now, in your book, you wrote about how Nixon, Reagan, and under the Bush administrations, both George H.W. and definitely under George W. Bush, they had a strategy to reach out to Latinos, and especially George W. Bush.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Under Nixon, at first, it was really about patronage politics, and Nixon would, you know, he worked hard to create more federal government jobs for Latinos, but he also, you know, appointed the first Hispanic treasurer of the United States. He created the National Economic Development Agency, and appointed Benjamin Fernandez as its head. So he was all about appointments and creating federal government opportunities for Latinos. Reagan was the first Republican president to really try to craft an ideology-based message about what the core characteristics of Latino Republican identity were, and they included things like family values, a hard work ethic, anti-communism, free enterprise, all of these kinds of things. And, you know, that was kind of the core of the Republican identity, the Latino Republican identity. And interestingly, you know, Reagan was the one who apparently said to, this is how the story goes, said to the San Antonio advertising executive, Leonel Sosa, when Leonel Sosa was brought on to work on Reagan's Hispanic campaign, he said that, Leonel, you know, you've got the easiest job imaginable because Latinos are Republicans who just don't know it yet. And, you know, Hispanic Republicans still repeat that idea as a kind of pivotal moment when a Republican leader was kind of really reaching out to Latinos.
Did some of those inroads to attract Latinos, did it help the Republican Party?
Yeah, it sure did. I mean, in 1972, Richard Nixon became the first Republican president to win about a third of the Latino vote. And sometimes it's been a little less, sometimes it's been a little more, but that 1972 re-election bid really kind of raised the bar for Republican candidates recruiting Latinos in general, and it's kind of been the same ever since.
Now, President George W. Bush, he had a Latino, or at least one Latino, Latina, in his family.
Yes.
So that he, I guess he was more sympathetic, and he came from Texas.
Yeah, that's right. His brother Jeb was married to Columba Garnica de Gallo in Austin, Texas, at the Catholic Center there, and she changed her name to Columba Bush. But yeah, so that has kind of been one of the beginning of the Latino roots of the Bush family. But George H.W. Bush also made a real effort in 1980 when he ran in the primary campaigns against Ronald Reagan to recruit Latino voters. And he actually sent Jeb down to San Juan, Puerto Rico, which was having its first ever Republican primary in 1980, and had Jeb just kind of camp out there for months before the primary election. And as a result, George H.W. Bush actually won the Puerto Rican primary in 1980.
Let me ask you this. It seems like over the years, that sort of 30% mark, yeah, for Latinos, Latino vote Republican Party, that seems to have been a constant.
Yeah, it's fluctuated very little, you know. I mean, again, sometimes it goes up and down by a little bit, like 26, 27%. But even Donald Trump won 28%. Mitt Romney and John McCain won about that amount. George W. Bush is really the outlier, having won 40 and 44%, but, you know, he was the outlier, really.
What was it about George W. Bush that Hispanics seemed to gravitate to?
Well, I think there are a couple things. First, as I was talking about with Jeb Bush and George H.W. Bush, there had been this kind of long-standing family tradition of cozying up to Latino communities in Puerto Rico and Florida and Texas and California, elsewhere. So when George H.W. Bush ran for president in 1980 and 1988, he would send Jeb on, you know, campaign tours. He would go give speeches in Texas, California, all over the place. And this was part of the Bush family forming relationships with Latino communities. So I think George W. Bush had that going for him. He was also the governor of a border state, and in the 1990s had a much more kind of moderate stance on immigration and border issues than the Republican Party in general. I think it's important to remember in the 1990s that, you know, you have Pat Buchanan giving George H.W. Bush a serious primary challenge in 1992, and he was kind of running kind of as a xenophobe, someone who actually wanted to construct a border wall between the United States and Mexico. Then there was Proposition 187 in California, and then the Restrictive Immigration Bill in 1996. So the Republican Party took a really hard right turn on immigration in the 1990s. So George W. Bush really kind of pulled the party back from that brink, and Hispanic Republicans were extremely relieved. So I think it was the combination of his family's connections and the context of kind of pulling the Republican Party back from the brink of its anti-immigrant positions in the 1990s.
Do you think though non-Hispanic white Republicans wanted that initiative? Did they welcome it?
You mean the moderate tone, the more moderate tone of the George W. Bush years? That's a great question, man. I mean, I think non-Hispanic white Republicans have always wrestled with how inclusive to be and how much to kind of be, remain the white conservative party. You know, I think that that's been an amazing deep rift within the Republican Party. So I think many people did and many people didn't. I mean, there were people like Karl Rove who were all for it. There were people like Ralph Reed, the head of the, an evangelical Christian. I can't remember the name of his group. But people like Ralph Reed and Karl Rove were all for kind of making the Republican Party a big tent party that was really inclusive. But then there were other people who weren't. And I still think today you see those kinds of tensions exist within the Republican Party. And I do think the kind of reckoning within the Republican Party about what kind of party to become in the future is going to be one of the really important issues the party has to face.
Let me ask you this before we get too much into the weeds with Trump. Has you said your grandfather was Republican, yeah. Even still is today. Has he ever felt either lonely or odd, or has it put him at a distance with his other family members who are Hispanic?
No, you know, not really. I mean, it's his politics have been something that we've always argued about. And, you know, first of all, I will say that my grandfather was in the military. Then he worked washing dishes in silver mines. I don't know. You know, he was never, like, involved in the Republican Party. He didn't belong to any Republican Party groups or organizations, nothing like that. So his Republican identity wasn't really, like, a social thing for him. It was just what he believed. And the arguments and conversations we had about it were always just within the family, you know. And, you know, I would say that I don't think he felt lonely. I think we were his family and we loved him. We didn't, like, isolate him or, you know, push him off to a corner when we were talking about politics. We had these conversations with him. We talked about the border. We argued about the border. He always talked about Bill O'Reilly and Lou Dobbs and said, you know, they're really looking out for me. They have my best interests in mind. So he would say things like that, and we would kind of shrug it off and be dismissive and laugh and maybe disagree. But, you know, he's my grandpa, you know. Yeah, right. I love him.
Do you consider yourself a Republican?
I am not. I'm a Democrat. I've been a Democrat my whole life. But I do think that for, you know, an important part of knowing who Latinos are in general, not just as voters, but as human beings, as a community, I think it's really important to understand who the, you know, third of Latinos who vote for Republicans are. I think that's an important part of understanding Latinos in general.
A lot of white or Anglo folks might say, oh, but what, you know, there are Hispanic Republicans, but what kind of Hispanics? Cubans or Mexicans? It seems, writing from your book, it's just a hodgepodge. It doesn't really matter what your background is. Yeah, generally Cubans from Miami tend to be Republicans, but I'm seeing more Puerto Ricans, Mexicans being Republican too.
Yeah, so I think in a lot of ways, you know, the main idea I was trying to write against was the idea that Latino conservatism can be reduced to Cuban exile identity or Catholics with traditional family values or ideas about marriage and abortion. You know, that's just not what I found when I started to interview people, when I got into the archives. I found that it was a much more diverse, national, broad movement than that. Yes, it's true that, you know, you can find Cubans in South Florida who vote for Republicans in greater percentages than other Latinos elsewhere. But even to this day, like 25 years after Proposition 187 in California, you're still going to find 23, 24, 25% of Latinos in California, where the Republican Party has supposedly been dead for 25 years, about a quarter of Latinos there are going to vote for Donald Trump. So it's really everywhere. It's a diverse movement.
Okay, so then Donald Trump starts, you know, his rhetoric during his campaign, and he's continued that. You definitely describe his tweet about, you know, Mexicans being rapists and coming abroad. That definitely, I mean, I've talked to some Republican Hispanics about this, but that definitely was a racist tweet.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, I'm not going to sit here and debate whether or not calling Mexicans rapists and criminals and thieves is racist. I mean, I think it's definitely racist. I think that, you know, he would say, I'm not even going to try to justify what he said. It's just racist. And there's no doubt that his administration has kind of borne out some of those ideas. They've had some of the most restrictive immigration policies in modern times. He's also continued to say things about Mexican immigrants as criminals and calling them animals. And it's under his administration where we've seen, you know, kids separated from their family members and families torn apart and migrants placed in detention centers that have poor conditions, those kinds of things. So, you know, what's been amazing to watch with Trump's Latino outreach is they've almost lived in this kind of friction-free fantasy zone where none of that comes up. I mean, he talks a lot about how well Latinos have done economically. You know, they have higher rates of home ownership, higher median incomes, and low rates of unemployment. All of this is before COVID, of course, and they like to, you know, talk a lot about the pre-COVID economy, and I'm always confused about that because it seems like a fiction. There's no such thing as the pre-COVID economy anymore because it's really just about moving forward and who's going to get us back on track, right? So, you know, all of Trump's outreach efforts and the Latinos for Trump campaign have existed in this, you know, friction-free zone of positivity where they haven't really been called to account for the immigration policies.
With that, with a lot of his rhetoric, his statements, are you surprised, though, he's managed to perhaps not even maintain that 30% benchmark for Republicans, but even attract certain Hispanics? Are you surprised about that?
I'm not surprised about that in the slightest. I mean, the writing this book, The Hispanic Republican, has taught me that fairly consistently over the past 50 years, about 30% of Latinos have voted for the Republican Party. So, you know, as a historian, I can say that's a pretty consistent pattern, and there's very little reason. I mean, and I should say that, like, that pattern has continued even through the times that the Republican Party has taken a right turn on immigration. So, you know, as a historian, those patterns lead me to believe that he'll have the same kind of success in 2020. That said, you know, history also teaches you that just because things have been one way for 50 years doesn't mean that they're destined to be that way for the next 50 years. Change can happen anytime. And in some ways, this moment is ripe for change with the pandemic and the Black Lives Matter protests and the economic harm and death caused by the pandemic. So we'll see. But, you know, if I had to guess right now, I would expect that Trump will maintain his support or maybe even grow it a little bit, as you said. I mean, there's no doubt that the Latinos for Trump campaign has made Latinos a critical group of voters over the past few months. In many ways, they are central to Trump's success, and everything is pointing to them continuing that outreach effort. So I think that would be partially responsible for his continued success.
Yeah, but when you say that, continuing that outreach effort, it's almost like the outreach effort by bashing Hispanics?
Right. Well, there's no doubt. Yes, it's a head-scratcher. It's totally a head-scratcher. But this is where they've kind of maintained this consistent drumbeat about the economy, about defending religious freedom, about Trump being the leader who's going to stand up to leftist leaders in Latin America. Those are the messages that are getting across, and they would say that all of the other things you're hearing about, like the boycott Goya, or like take for example the kids in cages and separation of families, what they argue there is that that was a policy initiated during the Obama years, and of course the scale wasn't as much, the conditions weren't as bad. Nevertheless, that's not important. You know, it's an answer to the challenge. And so in many ways, his supporters, and they say this over and over, right? Like, immigration and the border rank comparatively low on their list of priorities compared with jobs, education, healthcare. And on those issues that they say they care more about compared with immigration, there are conservative positions like school choice, like anti-abortion, like financial deregulation and tax cuts that there is a percentage of Latinos who are motivated by.
How did your grandfather square all this? How did, when you talk to him, do you talk to him still about all this?
Yeah, of course.
About the separation of children, all this other rhetoric stuff.
So no, I don't still talk to him at this point. Honestly, he's 95, living in a VA home.
He's not changing.
He's not changing, but he also, you know, these days I talk to him about the movies he's watching. You know, we don't get into kind of political arguments anymore, but...
But you used to.
We used to, no doubt. I mean, in the 90s into the 2000s, we would talk about these things because, you know, the 2000s, for example. I wrote my first book about the Arizona-Sonora border, and I went out to Tucson for a year to do my dissertation research in 2006 and 2007. This is when Congress was debating things like the Secure Fence Act and the McCain-Kennedy bill, all these, you know, punitive immigration reforms that would lead to the construction of border walls along the Arizona border, these things. So I was really talking to my grandpa then about border politics, and he would just say the same thing that many Latino conservatives say today, which is, I came legally, I did it the right way, I'm not against immigration, I'm just against illegal immigration. That's what they say. And I would try to argue with him about, like, but grandpa, you don't understand. It's not as easy as just, like, studying for the citizenship test and taking it and becoming a citizen. People wait 20, 30 years for this. I remember thinking about this line when Melania Trump gave her speech at the Republican National Convention this year, because she said, like, I studied hard for the citizenship test and I became a citizen. I was like, well, that sounds so easy. You make it sound so easy, you know?
Yeah, that's all you
need to do. It's all you got to do. Just study a little bit, take the test, and you're good, you know? So those are the kinds of things he would say. I just think that it's a matter of emphasis and the issues that certain groups prioritize. And here's the thing I would warn against. I would just warn against seeing Latino Republican support for Trump as some kind of, like, false consciousness or some sort of
self-hatred,
self-loathing, selling out, some sort of betrayal of your race. I just don't believe that Latino conservatives see themselves this way. No one I interviewed said, like, oh, I'm a sellout. I'm a race traitor. I am, you know, acting against my own interests. It's just that I think that everyone has a very different view of what their own interests are, you know? So in that sense, yeah, you know, maybe Latino conservatives tend to be the ones who earn more. Maybe they have lighter skin. Maybe they're business owners, so they're into financial deregulations. All of those things. But none of that is a matter of, like, false consciousness. It's just a different set of interests. And I think that that's why it's important to take them seriously, because you can't just dismiss individuals who have sincerely held beliefs. You can disagree with them. I think you should disagree with them, and you should argue with them about things like school choice or policy toward Latin America or whether the tax cut actually benefits Latinos broadly, those kinds of things. I think you should have those serious, reasoned debates about policy, but don't dismiss them as sellouts or race traitors. It doesn't get us anywhere in terms of understanding who Latinos are.
I think it's safe to assume that Latinos as a group will never vote as a huge one-sided voting bloc for either party.
Never. But I think it's been assumed that they would. I think it's always assumed that Latinos are natural Democrats. I mean, I guess both parties have made the argument that Latinos are naturally one way or the other. They're either naturally conservative because of family values, abortion, whatever, or they're naturally liberal because, you know, they have been discriminated against in the United States. They've been, you know, subjected to all kinds of economic and social inequalities, those kinds of things. And those kinds of ideas are behind statements that Latinos are natural Democrats or natural conservatives. But I don't think Latinos or anyone are naturally anything. I don't think you're born as a Democrat or a Republican. I think your partisan identity, your political beliefs, they're a product of, you know, where you grew up, your family relationships, what your sense of right and wrong in the world is. And I think that's how political identity develops. And I think that, to your point, yes, I think that Latinos are going to remain a kind of diverse voting group, just like they should be. I mean, in some ways, they're Americans, just like all other Americans. Why can't Latinos have complicated, contradictory ideas, just like every other group?
Right. And with that, even though it's about 30%, but there's enough of the Latinos out there that even if it switches by 2 or 3%, either way, that could mean a lot in terms of the outcome of an election, especially in swing states where you don't think I'm not really sure what the population, Hispanic population is in Wisconsin, Michigan, or Florida. We know it's bigger.
Yeah.
But 1 or 2 points can sway that election outcome.
I looked up just a few days ago. I looked up what the 10 states were with the slimmest margin of victory in 2016. Either way, right? So they were, of course, states like Florida, Arizona, where we know there are a lot of Latinos, but those states also included Wisconsin, Minnesota, Michigan, and Maine. So I looked that up, and then I went and looked up what the Latino population in those states are, the Latino voting population more particularly, and in every single case except for Maine, the number of Latinos living in those states was larger. Voting Latinos was larger than the margin of victory in 2016. So, you know, all it takes is a break in one direction or another. Just take Florida for one example, a state we hear a lot about. Trump's margin of victory in 2016 was 110,000 votes. There are something like 3.1 million Latinos in the state. I can't remember if that's the population or the voting population. The point is, there are tens of times, like, you know, factors and exponentially more Latinos in the state than the number of votes that Trump won by. And that's why, you know, places like Miami-Dade, but also Tampa and Central Florida are going to be super hard fought, because movements, you know, of 5, 10, 15,000 voters really make a difference.
Just in the future, what... If Trump wins this re-election, do you only see Hispanic support for Republicans just maybe going to be breaking that 30% mark?
I think here's the issue. The way the demographics are changing in the United States, we know now that Latinos are about 18% of the American population. That number is going to rise maybe to 30% by the year 2040, maybe 35-40% by the year 2050. You know, so the population is growing. And the Latino population is one of the fastest growing communities in the United States. This year, for the very first time in 2020, Latinos are the second largest block of voters, only behind non-Hispanic whites. For the first time, there are more Latino voters than African-American voters. There will be 1 million new Latino voters in 2020. So you get the picture. The picture is that the Latino population is growing and the Latino electorate is growing. So I just don't think that it's going to be a winning strategy well into the future for Republicans to continue to win only 30% of the Latino vote. Winning 30% of anything is never like a long-term recipe for success, you know? So they're going to have to figure out how to grow their Latino base. And I think there are some evidence now that they're already getting there, you know? In a lot of the conversations I've been having with Hispanic Republicans, it's actually the older Hispanic Republicans, those who came into the Republican Party during years that they considered to be more inclusive, like during the Nixon years, the Reagan years, the Bush years. They are the Hispanic Republicans who are most wrestling now with their continued support for the Republican Party. It's the older Hispanic Republicans who are questioning whether they can continue to support Republicans given the shifts within the party. It's actually not the younger Latinos. They don't know a different Republican Party. The Republican Party they know is Trump's Republican Party, and they are, you know, I'm not going to say that they're eating it up, because there's all kinds of evidence that Latino youth are more progressive, they skew more liberal than older Latinos, and that's true, but, you know, it's kind of been surprising that there has been some appetite for Trump's message among Latino youth.
And they don't see it as racist.
Well, I don't know that they don't see it as racist. I mean, I don't think they love it. You know, you'll hear Latino Republicans of all ages say over and over, like, I don't like how he talks. I wish he would kind of moderate his tone. But I like some of his policies. I like that he supports free enterprise. I like that he supports economic growth. I like that he wants to create jobs, those kinds of things. I like that he supports school choice. I mean, a third of all students in charter schools are Latinos. And I think that that's why Biden and Democrats have to come up with responses directly to Trump's positions on education and religious freedom, things like that. They have to engage those issues directly. I don't think it's going to be enough for Biden to just say, look at what this guy has done on immigration and the border. He's thrown kids in cages. As shocking and as horrible that is, I don't think that that's going to be the thing that's going to increase Biden's support.
Even among Trump has totally overtaken the narrative of law enforcement and lawlessness. I mean, it seems like most police officers are supporting him in droves.
Totally. And I think that's a really important point, because there are a lot of Latino police officers, a lot of Latino border patrol officers, a lot of Latinos serving in the military. And I've heard a lot of commentators talk about how the diversification of the military and the border patrol and the police forces in the United States is going to kind of muddle the politics of those traditionally conservative institutions. And I don't know that that's the case, because I think it's just as likely that the diverse members of those institutions are going to be conservative, you know? So I think that, yeah, law and order is another issue that, we know that Joe Biden is already kind of in a pickle with how he talks about law enforcement and police reform, because the different wings of the Democratic Party have very different ideas about that. But it's a tricky issue with Latino communities as well.
It's lonely being a Hispanic Trump supporter. It seems like a lot of them, and I asked some of them, they feel like some of their personal relationships, friendships have hurt because of their support for President Trump and his reelection. But most part, you don't think they feel somehow isolated or lonely, it'd be so much easier if they were a Democrat, but they're a Republican, and that comes maybe with a cost.
I mean, they certainly feel themselves to be in a minority in their community. They know, as much as they talk about, I mean, some of Trump's supporters, one from right here in Chicago, a guy named Steve Cortez, he tweeted in March that Trump's going to win the Latino vote. Like, he will win 50% of the Latino vote. That has never happened. It's not going to happen. That's pure fantasy. But, you know, despite statements like that, Latino Republicans know that they are in a minority. I don't know that they feel incredibly isolated or marginalized from the Latino community. I mean, they all have family members, you know, maybe, you know, there are tense Thanksgiving or dinner time or Christmas time conversations, but, you know, I think that they are part of our community. That's one of the things I really wanted to get across. And just take, for example, Nixon's appointment as the first Hispanic treasurer of the United States, a Mexican-American woman from East Los Angeles named Romana Acosta Bañuelos. She owned a tortilla factory in East LA. She started a Hispanic-serving bank called the Banco del Pueblo and the Pan American National Bank in East LA. And she was a Republican. She served in the Nixon administration, but in the 1990s, she received like a lifetime award for community service. Even though she was a Mexican-American Republican in East LA, she was a valued member of her community. And so, you know, maybe it's just that times have become more tense since the 1990s, and, you know, the Trump era maybe has had the potential to really split friends and family apart like no other political era before. But at least historically, I mean, I think Hispanic Republicans have been important members of their communities as well. You know, one potentially dark way of understanding the moment we're living in right now, the 2010s and what could happen in the 2020s, is that we're just really wrestling as a society with the meaning and fact of demographic change. So it was in the 2010s where, you know, for the first time, I think it was in 2013 or 2014, the majority of babies born in the United States was non-white. I think it was for the first time where many more communities across the United States became majority-minority. I always get it confused whether it's majority-minority or minority-majority, but where more than half of the residents of a place are non-white. So, you know, it's just a fact that we are seeing the demographic transformation of the United States. And I think that that makes some people very, very nervous. And so one way of understanding this moment is just the kind of, in some ways, like birthing pangs of a new American society, you know? There's a new American society being born that is majority non-white. And that isn't going to be easy, that transition, you know? And I think that that's probably responsible for a lot of the anxiety that Trump supporters in particular and many Republicans generally are probably feeling. So, you know, I think that maybe I'm thinking about this as a historian where I can kind of see long periods of time and kind of macro scale, long-term transitions. Maybe that's why I'm seeing it in these terms, but no one thought that that demographic transition was going to be easy.
Gerardo Cadava is a history professor at Northwestern University. He's the author of the book, The Hispanic Republican, and we'll be back with more Off Mic. Well, welcome back to Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Michael Puente. On Tuesday, Lakeshore Public Radio will host a debate with the candidates in the 1st Congressional District race. I recently caught up with two of the candidates, Republican Mark Leyva and Democrat Frank Marvan. They were both attending separate rallies. Let's start off with Republican Mark Leyva, who was at the Freedom Rally at the Lake County Fairgrounds in Crown Point.
So how's the campaign going?
I think the campaign is doing wonderful. We're moving forward. The talk on the street is, it's just a lot of Democrats, it's had enough. They say that the Democratic Party has left them. And it's a time that they're wearing Trump hats and voting straight Republican. I just hear a lot of support out there. There's a lot, I have union guys, 150 guys, helping me out. I have steel worker guys helping me out. I just have a bunch of everybody. I have a big assorted support, groups from all over walks of life, from motorcycle groups to religious groups to just everyday hardworking people. I've been preparing my whole life for this, and I just think that I'm in the right spot at the right time with the right movement that is going to take me and hopefully take me to Washington with the help of my supporters and the help of God.
Is this, you ran in the past a couple of times. How what's the number? Is this like number 3 or 4?
No, I have to say that the number is much larger. I would have to say maybe 8 or 10, at least 8 times. But this is the one and only time with a real chance and opportunity. The rest of the times we're just getting ready for an opportunity. Well, 2020 is my opportunity because the congressman retired. It's an open seat. So now people and everything that's happening in Washington, everything that's happening in all these crazy states with the anarchy and chaos and the protesters is just making strong family value Democrats say that the party's left them and we need to work to have law and order. And the only way to get law and order this election is to vote Republican.
And you have a number of support from steelworkers.
I have support from steelworkers, the blue-collar steelworkers themselves. I do not have the endorsement of the steelworkers. To be honest, I was interviewed by the steelworkers and intended to go to the second interview, but when they send me a survey questionnaire to do, it was just full of climate change and green New Deals, and you know what? I can't waste my time on that. I want to protect the jobs. I want to protect the hardworking steelworkers, but I am not going to commit to crazy nonsense commitment to a climate change or the Green New Deal.
But steel workers, especially early on, President Trump's first term, gravitated to Trump because of his tough stance on foreign steel, especially China.
Yes, you're totally right on that. And the other thing that gravitates to steel workers is because I have been a steel worker for 7 years. I worked in all those departments like the bar mills, the blast furnace, the coke plants, the centering plants. I've worked the same jobs that they worked. So I understand what they go through each and every day. You know, would you rather have a candidate that is a politician that doesn't even know anything about blue-collar work or have a guy that's a steel worker, former steel worker, and knows exactly what they're doing. And I want to help protect those jobs.
You're Latino, correct?
Yes.
Hispanic American, Mexican?
I'm Mexican American or American Mexican, first generation.
What is the appeal of Donald Trump to a Hispanic like yourself?
Well, I think what it does is he created a strong economy. He created a lot more jobs, and he also, the wages in the low to middle class went up. And most of our Hispanics that are in that job area have more money on their paychecks, and they have more jobs, and that's what they want.
Some say some of his comments, some of his tweets have been considered anti-Latino or rough. Do you see it that way, or do you think they've been misconstrued by the press?
No, it's misinterpreted by the press. I think the Latino community sees the actions that this president brought to their families, to their paychecks, to their jobs, okay? And the Democratic Party is losing their Latino base, they're losing their black base, and they're losing a lot of base in general, because this is a president that has done everything that he said he was going to do. Now, the biggest problem that I think Donald Trump has, that most people are concerned, is sometimes the way he tweets or makes rough comments. But other than that, his actions are better than any president that we've had in the past.
Are you finding more Latinos gravitating to him?
Yes, running into many, you know, from just regular working jobs to waitress jobs to all types of jobs. And of course, we're still going to have some that maybe watch one or two channels and don't really have the truth. So you're going to have some of the naysayers, but the majority are for Donald Trump. Everybody wants to be here. This is a country that everybody wants to be here because there's great opportunities. I just think we need to do it the legal way. That's all.
Mark, good luck.
Next, we have Democrat Frank Marvan. He recently attended a rally in Valparaiso.
We're less than 2 months away from the big election, not just for Congress, but also bigger things on the president. What do you think, what message does Joe Biden still have to get out there? Who does he got to reach?
Well, first and foremost, here in the first district, I think who we have to reach is making sure that Joe Biden is talking to working men and women and talking to people who are affected by the pandemic, who have lost their jobs, and talking about how we're going to get our economy back on track, an infrastructure bill, investing in that, Buy American provisions so that our steel industry is protected and our steel workers are consistently back to work, and that we have trade deals that allow us to make sure that we protect our steel industry. So Joe Biden has to be able to protect our interests in our district. And so that's the first step. And I think he's doing a good job when he's talking about bringing America back to work and following through with what he says.
You know, Frank, early on when President Trump took office, he made a lot of moves that made him somewhat appealing to steel workers. And I heard a lot of steel workers were supporting him. Have you found that? I mean, do you think Democrats can sort of regain back some of that support from local steel workers?
I do believe that we are going to regain the support of the steel workers, because those were a lot of empty promises. We've seen mills cut back. We've seen mills close. We've seen steel workers lose their jobs. And so they know they are at ground zero when it comes to that, knowing what is really going on and what political talk is. And so when you have over, I think it's 150 mills closed, and thousands of steel workers losing their jobs, and with the slowdown and with the production, we've got to be able to protect our steel industry as a step as national security. And so there's been a lot of empty promises, and steel workers are smarter than that.
What are you doing now, between now and the election, to get your message out there? And do you feel that, you know, some, you know, pundits aren't looking at Indiana as being in play, but you think Biden still might have a shot here in Indiana?
So first and foremost, how I'm getting my message out is how we did it before. We are active, engaged. We're making sure that we're doing door drops. We're working closely with the United Steelworkers, with volunteers, and we're getting our message out by phone, by text, by email, by Facebook. You can go to Mervan for Congress on Facebook. But your question is directly about Joe Biden and how he's infecting Indiana. Every vote counts. And this election is one of the, you know, it's said time and time again, but it's critical. And it's a time for choosing. You got to choose between what you stand for and what our country's all about. And I'm about unifying our country. I think we're much stronger unified than we are divided. And I believe Joe Biden has that same thought.